Hello and welcome to Canary Pod, a podcast from the team behind the Canary. I'm Nancy Mendoza, the Canary's Communications and Membership Director, and I'm here this week with UK editor Bex Sumner and Canary writer Steve Topple. This week we are talking the reshuffle kerfuffle. That's been the story that's been dominating the news since we came back from the festive break. Now, I know a bit about what's happened, but I haven't had a chance to really kind of get down and delve into what this reshuffle has kind of meant and what are the significant moves that have happened. So I'm going to ask Bex and Steve to give me a bit of an overview of what's happened, and then we can talk a bit about some of the significant bits. So, yeah, tell me, what has Theresa May been doing with her cabinet since we got back from New Year?
Well, she's really been issuing the last gasp of a dying government. It's like, it was meant to be a simple reshuffle. Basically, Damian Green was fired over lies about porn on his computer.
Did he fall or was he pushed? He resigned, didn't he?
He technically resigned, but it was effective. It was an effective sacking, yeah. Really, a reluctant sacking.
Yeah.
So it was meant to be a fairly simple reshuffle to sort of fill his post and make a couple of tactical moves, because she's got so little power she can't really do much anyway. But even that went catastrophically wrong. It was, you know, she had ministers refusing to move, she had the Conservatives announce positions and then had to delete them seconds later. To top it all off, she's now facing claims that she breached the ministerial code by staging a PR stunt at Downing Street, which breaches regulations. Yeah, they still couldn't get it right. It was basically a bit like watching her, you know, her catastrophic coughing fit speech, but agonisingly spread out over 2 days. That would be my...
So a metaphorical coughing fit following the resignation of Damian Green.
Painful metaphorical coughing fit.
Steve, do you agree? Was it a coughing fit or what was she up to?
Yes, no, yeah, I agree. It was a metaphorical coughing fit, and it was one of those coughing fits where just a little bit of sick comes up as well. It was a disaster on top of disaster on top of disaster, really. Yeah. Tactically, you could kind of see what she was attempting to do. There were some interesting promotions with the likes of Damien Hines to Education Secretary, another sort of fairly unknown quantity, but one who's already been tipped along with Gavin Williamson to be future contenders for leader of the Conservative Party.
Right.
Obviously, as Bex alluded to, you had the situation with ministers refusing to move. Specifically, we all know that was Mr. Hunt with the health brief.
Who
ended up having some sort of bizarre promotion, really, and he ended up getting social care as well, which obviously resulted in cheers from all elderly people around the country.
Because he's done so well as health secretary, he's gone into that and he's thought, right, I'm going to really improve things for vulnerable people, not. Mm-hmm.
Quite.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, he told her that a captain doesn't abandon his ship, which prompted like loads of jokes on Twitter about sinking ships and stuff. But it's really not a joke, because, you know, years of underfunding, horrific cuts to social care, tens of thousands of NHS vacancies, privatisation ideology. And he goes in, he argues for an hour, and rather than being moved to business, he refused to go and came out with a promotion.
That's just... He refused to go. I mean, in what situation in life, when you've got a job and someone says, this job isn't for you anymore, I've got another role that I need you to fill. Like, in what situation can you just dig your heels in and say, no, I'm not moving?
That's the challenge. I think you can, though, with Theresa May, because he knows full well that if she had agreed and moved him to another department, that would have immediately been leapt on as a failure of their policy in the past 7 years on the, well, past 5 years on the NHS, because he's been the longest serving health minister in quite a while. He's been in since 2012. Yeah. And it would have been an indication, if you like, of Theresa May's acceptance that things were not working out in the NHS. And she couldn't possibly move him while this winter crisis is happening. It would have been a PR disaster for her. So I think he has her over an absolute barrel, if you like. And hence why the screaming child kicking and screaming got his own way.
It's interesting you bring up the winter crisis, Steve, because... you know, that's something that the emergency services have been predicting for, you know, a long, long time, since much, much earlier this year. They were saying, look, we're going to have a real problem. We're already, you know, seeing the kind of the inklings of that earlier in the year. And, you know, yet again, this is a government that doesn't listen to the experts. So I do see what you're saying. You know, it would be a pretty damning admission that things have gone very wrong with the NHS under Mr. Hunt. However, you know, how much longer can we kind of sit here with this sort of la la la, nothing going on here, nothing to see, move on kind of attitude?
No, quite. And I mean, there's some sickening irony, really, in the fact that she has given him the social care brief, because Labour, of course, are saying that social care and the NHS need to be combined into one service. So, in one hand, it would appear that Theresa May and her government is listening to that, but doing it under them, we all know it's just going to be an absolute disaster.
Well, you know, we'll end up with G4S running everything.
There's just, it's really, I mean, I know we're often quite light-hearted on this podcast and it's fairly, you know, fairly jovial at times. However, this is really quite bad. Goodness knows what is now going to happen to, I mean, but never mind what's already happened to social care, you know, billions being cut from local authorities' budgets. This is, it could be absolutely catastrophic, really.
Yes, and it's an insult. It's a real kick in the teeth for anyone who needs social care and to NHS staff and patients. I think John McDonald tweeted something, and you wrote about it, Steve, you know, saying now she's given him the opportunity to completely balls up social care too.
Now, and he was not the only one to dig his heels in and refuse to move, was he?
No, Justine Greening tried, and she had a very different result.
That's interesting.
May wanted to move her from education to the DWP.
Yeah.
It feels a bit odd for me to say this. I'm not entirely comfortable with myself saying this, but she wasn't that bad, Greening. She could have been worse. she blocked grammar schools, Theresa May's plans to do grammar schools. Yeah. I mean, she's done lots of rubbish stuff as well. But she had been sort of, teachers didn't hate her that much. She was kind of doing quite well with popularity for teachers, getting them on side, even though there's a massive education crisis still going on, obviously, at the moment. But yeah, she spent 2 hours in Downing Street and came out with no job, basically. She refused the move to the DWP.
I think the challenge with Justine Greening is she was always, you're quite right to say that she wasn't, in some respects, that bad as education secretary. She blocked a lot of things, and I think that was the issue with her for many people in the Conservative Party. She blocked, if you like, some of the more radical policies that progressive Conservatives wanted to get forced through, like tuition fees, like trying to counter Corbyn somewhat with regards to tuition fees.
Yeah.
And of course, it's Theresa May's former aide, Nick Timothy, which has been sticking the knife in with her. I mean, he wrote a damning column about her in The Sun, I think it was last week. Mm. And then, of course, he's come out and released the fact that she blocked a review into possibly lowering tuition fees, just to put that knife in a bit more, if you like. So I think it's not unexpected that she went, because she's a slight thorn in the side. I mean, if you looked at PMQs yesterday as well, she was almost sitting on the Tories' naughty step, wasn't she? It was flanked by, I think it was Nicky Morgan and Anna Soubry, in what they were calling the Remainers' naughty corner.
Yeah, but that's also the point. It just shows again how, you know, Theresa May solved one problem in her education policy, but she's created another one now, hasn't she? She's created a potential rebel on Brexit.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So, yeah. It just out of the frying pan into the fire.
I mean, is she really that unsavvy? Maybe she is.
It does make you wonder, doesn't it?
It really does. It's like
she's got no choice. She's got no choices, really. She's just she's just got her back against the wall, and she's dealing with like a very small pool of people who support her.
Yeah.
She's backed into a corner. I mean, you wonder how long it can stagger on.
Almost start feeling slightly sorry for her.
I'm
sure it's no secret, really, that you know, in the public sector, civil service, underperformance is tolerated like it is in no other sector of employment. And, you know, what we see is that, you know, our MPs are no different. You know, the departments that they're overseeing are underperforming, and that, you know, that has a lot to do with how these things are managed, and they're often managed, you know, within civil service very, very poorly. Well, I'm talking on a sort of micro level here of you know, do people know what their job is about and what they're trying to achieve and what the vision is? I think often they don't, and you know, that's partly because it seems to change every 2 minutes. It's very difficult for people to kind of generate the kind of energy and enthusiasm and drive to make this stuff really happen and really work, because, you know, they're being poorly managed, they're being told left, right and centre there's no money to do anything, everybody hates us anyway, so what's the point? I mean, it's just,
exactly, know, and if you think about all the resources that are being poured into Brexit, I mean, there's nothing else really happening.
I think it's a very good point, Nancy, actually. There was some interesting pieces of government documentation out last year. They did their annual staff surveys on every government department.
That's,
and I was
right.
reading Revenue and Customs one, and I think it came back that only around 15% of civil servants working for HMRC felt that they were paid fairly for their jobs. All the other results as well about sort of leadership and management and how they feel valued, there were no sort of positive scores in this survey over 60%. The results were quite terrible. For how civil servants feel working for HMRC.
Yeah, I mean, HMRC is a really good example, actually. You know, people will probably remember a few years ago that a solicitor at HMRC blew the whistle on the sweetheart deal with Goldman Sachs.
Mm.
His job is to make sure that people pay their taxes, individuals and businesses. And that they pay the right amount of tax. And when he looks at something and sees that, you know, a company isn't paying the tax it's supposed to, and actually the agreement that's been made with them is probably illegal, and he puts his hand up and says, hang on, guys, you know, this doesn't look right. And he ends up in the position where he has to blow the whistle and talk to the media about what's happening, because internally he's being told, no, we don't want you to do your job.
No, of course, absolutely.
People get demoralised when they don't experience the kind of self-actualisation of being actually able to achieve something and to do what they're told is the aim in their role. And I think that's pretty common across the civil service and public sector more generally.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point, Nancy. The civil service is generally very demoralised, but I think it's an issue which is pervading this current Conservative government under Theresa May as well. I mean, you only had to look at PMQs yesterday, and the backbenchers, their faces looked like they really did not want to be there, and it was like they'd all still got New Year's hangovers, if you like, in this Wednesday's PMQs. But you have to then juxtapose that actually with what the Conservative press office is doing, because it was quite interesting on Thursday. They're obviously doing something right, because they were dominating the front pages with Conservative-led stories. stories. Obviously, the Conservative Party would have a grid of stories that they issue each week, the same way the Labour Party have a grid of stories, which is what they want their MPs and their PR teams to push. And the Tories succeeded with this on Thursday. The papers were dominated by the story about the plastic initiative, the fairly positive vibes in some respects about Hammond's visit to Germany regarding Brexit and trade deals, positive stories in the Times about possible access to the single market for financial services. The Tories won the PR war a bit this week in terms of stuff aside from the reshuffle. So it's almost as if it's Theresa May who's dragging it all down, and the PR team are kind of bundling along quite...
trying to keep it afloat.
Yeah. Trying to keep it afloat, absolutely. If you don't mind. The other interesting point which I wrote about, and it had a huge reaction on social media, was, of course, the return of Esther McVeigh.
Oh. Yeah. This was shocking.
Yeah.
Esther McVeigh, who we should say, lost her seat in 2015.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then made a return with a majority of 14,000 to George Osborne's old seat in 2017. And she's now back in the cabinet as Secretary of State for the Department for Work and Pensions.
This frightens me quite a lot, Steve. Yeah. This, you know, I'm, as a person with a disability, I'm in receipt of personal independence payment, which, you know, is important to keep me able to work. I'm frightened, literally.
Yeah, absolutely. The reaction has been quite staggering to her coming back to cabinet, if you like. I mean, her track records speak for itself. And the thing is with this, Nancy, okay, I'm going to sort of lay it on the line here. There's been a lot of criticism from the sort of centrists in Labour over the past few days before we recorded this about how the far left in Labour and the Green Party are ganging up on Esther McVeigh and its abuse and its misogynistic and its sexist. Now, obviously, there would be some elements of that with online Twitter trolls who don't represent the views of journalists who write about Esther McVeigh, nor the views of most people on the left of the Labour Party or any other political persuasion for that matter. However, Esther McVeigh has been responsible for some of the most nefarious policies of the past 7 years. She was Ian Duncan Smith's second in command. And let's also bear in mind with Esther McVeigh, in 2003, she helped set up Ian Duncan Smith's Centre for Social Justice think tank. It's a right-wing think tank on welfare, which is responsible for a lot of the reforms we've seen come into force as well. And especially sick and disabled people, they have a right to be angry with her. I mean, there was that notorious speech she did in 2013 in Parliament about food banks. And yes, okay, so the centre of the party is condemning some of the abuse she's getting. Luciana Bergener, who is a pretty much centrist Labour MP, was all over the news because she spoke out and reminded people of that specific food bank speech which Esther McVeigh gave, where she basically said there was no issue with food banks, that they were a sign of the Tories were doing something right. And then when pretty terrible stories were being read out by opposition MPs about people's experiences with food banks, she and Ian Duncan Smith just walked out of the debate and didn't stay and listen. And I mean, she's pernicious in the extreme, and I think it's a bit deeper than that with her. It's not even necessarily her doing her job. I think there's an element of she really believes that a good proportion of sick and disabled people should be in work, that they are not entitled to help from the state. I think it's something ideological in her. And as Linda Burnip, the co-founder of DPAC, summed up in the statement she gave for my article, Esther McVeigh is the epitome of the adage that the shit rises to the top. And unfortunately,
that's rather vivid, isn't it?
It is rather vivid. I think it's rather true, though, unfortunately. And I mean, in the same way Jeremy Hunt now having the social care brief, goodness knows what this is going to mean for the Department for Work and Pensions. I mean, we haven't even seen a lot of the cuts that are still to come yet from the DWP. Obviously, there's still the freeze on working age benefits until 2020. It just beggars belief. And it, for me, that's probably the biggest story of the reshuffle, if you like, because it's shocking news for a lot of people, and a lot of people are really scared and angry about this. So for me, that was the biggest story of the reshuffle, was Estimate Vay coming back.
Yeah, definitely, I'd agree. It's an absolute nightmare. She was Disabilities Minister, wasn't she, from 2012 to 2013? Yeah. And I think John McDonnell called her a stain on humanity, didn't he?
Am I right in saying she was also one of the people responsible for the bedroom tax?
Yeah, she was one of the ones who signed off on that, if you like, formulated the policy around it. And yeah, she was in at the time when it was signed off on. Yeah. And she was a sort of great advocate of it, if you like.
Mm. And it's also worth saying she's now the fifth Secretary of State for Work and Pension in 2 years, I think it is.
Wow.
It's very telling about the state of the Conservative Party as well, the fact they've got through so many DWP Secretaries of State in the past 2 years, when the DWP has one of the largest departmental budgets to manage. It has a huge budget. I mean, admittedly, a lot of that is made up of pensions. Mm-hmm. However, it's a massive department. And with the fact that they've made so many flagship reforms, which they still stand by, the fact they've got through five different Secretary of States in the past 2 years says something about the confidence within their own party of what they're doing, that people maybe don't really want that job.
Well, I mean, it is one of the most contentious areas when it comes to government funding. I think, you know, we've got, I mean, even within the Conservative Party, I think, you know, there are many different views on what the role of the welfare state should be. There are those who still believe that, you know, the welfare state should be something that effectively supports everybody. That means that you know, nobody falls through the gaps, that nobody is in a position when something really unexpected and difficult happens in their life, which, you know, can happen to anybody. That, you know, the state is there to catch them as they fall. And there are others who think that the welfare state is only there for people who won't, can't, don't work. And, you know, and we see the same with, you know, attitudes to social housing. We see the same with employment law. We see the same with equality legislation, and, you know, and the enactment of all of those. I think, you know, I'm not surprised that it's a bit of a hot potato in that respect. And these politicians are kind of passing it between them. And what it would take somebody with some serious guts and conviction to really kind of see it through. And
Estimate Vay is that person, I think.
Well, is she? I mean, that's a good question. You know, she certainly has conviction.
Yeah.
She, you know, and that's, you know, from my point of view, I disagree with her on almost everything, and her convictions are likely to make my life less livable, you know. But, you know, there's every chance that she is the person who has that conviction, which, you know, just I think gives us even more reason to push for a change of government and push for a general election as soon as possible.
Yes, I think again, it's the only sort of reasonable option, if you like, because if you look at the fallout of the reshuffle and look at what's happening in the NHS, what's happening with the DWP, what's happening with transport as well, Chris Grayling's kept his job. I mean, the rail service in this country is on its knees nearly. It's an absolute state. Michael Gove, as a climate change denier and creationist, suddenly having an epiphany and now backing the green crap, if you like, in the environment. That's just a joke. The government is on its knees and in nearly sort of every area. And the only thing that's going to stop them, and they have to be stopped, especially with regards to DWP and with regards to health, they have to be stopped. Anything that can stop this is a general election. And we keep coming back to this on this podcast,
don't we?
But yeah, it is the only option left. I know, for example, I wrote about this week, People's Assembly have organised a demonstration on the 3rd of February about the NHS, which I, of course, would urge everyone to go to. However, I think we're past the point of these demonstrations actually being able to achieve anything, because there have been countless NHS demonstrations over the past few years which I've covered, and the Tories aren't going to listen. It's a show of support for the NHS, which I would applaud, but we're all out of options, and short of pitchforks at dawn outside Parliament, general election it is, I think, you know.
Bex, would you agree with that?
Yes, I think general election is the only way through this. And I agree that the Tories won't listen to what's to the fact that protests are going on and stuff. But what it might do is engage more people in the political issue and sort of get people behind parties that are supporting the NHS, and it gives more of a platform towards the amazing work that is being done to try and stop the Tories from dismantling the whole thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And you know, as I say, speaking as someone who relies on the NHS for my health, as you know, as many people do, I rely on the fact that, you know, for example, I can get a prescription prepayment certificate. As someone in work, earning a decent living, the fact that I need lots of prescriptions could actually give me quite a kind of financial burden. But at the moment, I can pay about 100 quid and get all my prescriptions for a year. And these are things that, you know, as I say, they make it possible for me to work. You know, I'm one of these people that, you know, Esther McVeigh's talking about, that, you know, I'm a disabled person and I should be working, and I am working. But I'm only working because of the support I get from the NHS and from the DWP. You know, that's why I find the narrative around that so kind of screwed up, because it's too simplistic. It doesn't take account of the fact that we're talking about individual people with individual circumstances. And, you know, if we say that our kind of driving force is getting people into work, I mean, we could talk about, you know, the availability of suitable work opportunities as another whole podcast. If we have that as our kind of raison d'etre, our reason to exist as the DWP, then it's just not going to work. What we have to have as our reason for having the DWP is this, you know, this safety net, is this, if your circumstances change and you find yourself in dire straits, there's a safety net here, and it's for everybody, and it's to enable everybody to have a fulfilled, satisfying life where they contribute, not just by working, but contribute to society by, you know, being a friend, a parent, a sibling, a volunteer, you know, all of these things that should be really fundamental to creating a society that we want to live in, that just seem to be disappearing into the distance. And I, you know, it does worry me. You know, we're not actually committing to the future with any of this. I mean, the education stuff is also, I know, you know, Bex, you say there have been some, you know, good things that have happened in education, but, you know, mostly what I'm hearing from teachers, you know, particularly in primary and secondary schools, is it's just becoming harder and harder for them to do their jobs.
Yeah, I mean, nearly half of state school teachers in England are planning to quit by 2021. 88% of state schools face further cuts. It's definitely in crisis. No, I agree. It's ultimately a question of whether we want to live in a humane society or not. In a way, ultimately, it's just, the reshuffle doesn't change very much. It's kind of a distraction. It's just made things a bit worse, especially in the DWP. But what it maybe has done is highlighted for the whole world to see that Theresa May has no power left at all, and she can't manage even the simplest of reshuffles. And hopefully, it'll just be another small step towards an urgently needed general election. Yeah.
Any other significant moves that I should know about?
So, yeah, there's the whole thing about Chris Grayling and Brandon Lewis being appointed to the post of Conservative Party chair. So Conservative Party's Twitter account officially congratulated Chris Grayling on his new post as chairman. And then the BBC confirmed it. And then seconds later, the Twitter congratulation disappeared.
Oh.
And Brandon Lewis suddenly was given the post. Yes, Brandon Lewis, a man who urged against including sprinklers in fire safety regulations.
Right.
So that was another little, just a little sign of the chaos that was going on at CCHQ.
So do we know, were they going to offer it to Chris Grayling at one point? Or was this just a trigger-happy tweet?
I presume they must have been. But yeah, something
we may never
something
know.
Changed there. We no, exactly. Know. And the other detail that I thought was really interesting was that the Conservatives were trying to spin this whole thing as making the government more like the country.
right.
Which was hilarious. So fewer sort of middle-aged white men, basically, was what they were trying to.
So we've got quite a lot of middle-aged white women now.
Well, after the reshuffle, I think we've still got 70% of all ministers are still men.
Right.
So it's just seven fewer than before.
It is an improvement. You know, we talk a lot about equality and equity on this podcast, and, you know, gender equality and equity is something that is, you know, very, very close to our hearts. And it is great to see more women taking posts in the cabinet. But I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that, you know, that's a significant move towards making the Conservative government more representative. Because,
exactly.
And still,
the Daily Mail's front page the next day, the headline was Massacre of the Middle-Aged Men.
vulnerable middle-aged men who have no advantages or privilege in life whatsoever.
Yep.
Just as a side note, the amount of ministers who received a private education has gone up since the last cabinet. She's managed to increase that as well. It's now 34% of her cabinet were privately educated.
What's the national average?
7%.
7%, yeah.
Yeah. So really, really, again, representative. Diversity in all its glory.
Hooray!
Hurrah!
But, you know, it's a nice idea, isn't it? That, you know, they're at least thinking about it. I know when we set up the Canary originally, you know, that was something that we felt was really important about our organisation. It was, you know, that we had people who were in the communities that they were writing about, you know, be that physically or in terms of identity. And, you know, we've got a pretty diverse team, you know, both in terms of education and in terms of social background and, you know, protected characteristics and all of that. And I think, you know, it genuinely does make us better at what we do. And I think in any environment, having that diversity makes you better at what you do, because, you know, you understand the context that you're working in. And, you know, it's certainly been the case for governments in the UK and elsewhere for forever that hasn't been the case. So, you know, I'll reluctantly say well done for thinking about it and well done for appointing some more women.
And of course we've still got Boris Johnson, so
yeah.
He doesn't seem to be going anywhere, does he?
No. He's got to have something on May.
He's got some shit on Theresa May, isn't
he? Must have, mustn't he?
Because he really has no right at all to be in that role.
No, indeed.
Ho-hum. Well, okay, so roll on a general election so we can get this horrible mess out and bring in something that, you know, might actually have a chance of being diverse and representative and, you know, aiming to make a world that works for everyone rather than making a world that just continues to work for the small percentage of rich people who it works for right now.
Hear, hear.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, well, Bex, Steve, thank you so much for joining me today on Canary Pod. To those of you listening at home, please review, rate, subscribe to Canary Pod on whatever platform you like to use, be that iTunes or Overcast or, you know, any of those. That helps people to find Canary Pod and to listen to it too. Until next week, that's it. And we look forward to getting your comments and reactions to the podcast on Twitter. We're at CanaryPod, and you can use hashtag CanaryPod to continue the conversation after you've listened. So see you next week, and until then, don't get angry, get involved.